Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
Osio Ogin Lee, this is Will Bluewater, and our guest this evening is David Crockett Williams. He holds a PhD in chemical physics from UC Santa Barbara, having previously earned his Bachelor of Science in Chemistry with Honor from Cal State Northridge, where my dad's cousin used to teach engineering. In the course of his work, he's been researching since 76 the theme of mutual prophecy fulfillment, which has involved his spiritual practice and involvement as an activist and event organizer and student of the teachings of Sri Sri. And my wife... my second wife has now passed away. She knew Sri Sri. Traditional Hopi interpreter Thomas Bunyakya. He's an acquaintance of our co-host Mark Borcherding. And he knows a lot of other folks like the Dalai Lama and all kinds of folks. And we mics are live, and we want to welcome you to Prophecy Keepers Radio, David.
Thank you very much. I want to correct one thing, though, that you said. I don't have the PhD in chemical physics. I applied for that in 1974, kind of naively thinking all I had to do was
fill out
the application, turn in my fee, but it turned out that that wasn't the way to do it, and my application was denied. So with my application, I turned in the first three equations because I wanted to do my thesis on the completing Einstein's vision of a unified field theory to describe all of physical reality, all events in nature, no matter where or when, with 100% certainty. And they didn't like that. So I found out later that you had to kind of brown nose around and get a sponsor and then get accepted. And then after 2 years, they tell you what you're going to do your thesis on. But in any case, I decided to go ahead on a follow an intuitive path to learn something I didn't know at that time, to complete these equations, which in essence describe the operation of the cosmic natural law that's a teaching common to not only Einstein's vision, but the various religions like the Dharma of Buddhism and the Torah of Judaism and Islam expressed as the will of God, all inviolably sovereign, meaning you can't go against it. Everything happens in accord with this law. So anyway, in the pursuit of that, I met Thomas Banyaka and kind of got zapped by him in a meeting and where he gave the Hopi prophecy talk and pursued a investigation of the theme of mutual prophecy fulfillment. And in April of 1977, I got the inspiration for the fourth of these equations to complete this set of equations. And I don't want people to get the wrong impression, because if you have a PhD in something, that means you've knuckled under to their basis of knowledge and
that's right.
Try to get out of that box.
Yeah, you ought to call into that show on Saturday night to leave a message with Michio Kaku and see what he has to say. But anyway, I'm sure you've grown past that. But Mark wants to do Mayan birth reading on you. We tell folks it should give you some insight into why you do what you do. Take it away, Mark.
Well, in the tradition, my own day count, you're born on a day one Ock. And so it's the beginning of a 13-day cycle. So that energy kind of carries throughout the entire 13 days. And the one, you know, well, it kind of speaks for itself. Unity, you know, creator, one creator and all that. It would also, in Mayan tradition, it also tends to be related to the bottom of the pyramid, not the top, but the bottom, where it connects into the ground, to the earth, and the power and the energy. So that the shape and the energy movement in a pyramid and its positioning in geometric shape is going to relate back to all those things you said about your equations. Now the Ock part of your, of the one Ock, that is also sometimes called the dog glyph. Interestingly enough, it also tends to be talked about as being related to the law, the law. And people born under that typically have a preponderance towards being kind of almost like a counselor, especially in areas of things being fair, things having to do with authority and power and stuff like that. Ock is also the relates to Shuatl, the dog of the underworld, which is Quetzalcoatl's sidekick. The one that kind of the seeing eye dog to take people from death through death into the other side. So kind of a, you know, seeing eye dog for the spiritual realm. So it might be some characteristics like that. It's related to color of white and also the direction of the north of ancestors. So now I'm going to switch over and go into the sixth sun Zolkin for the next cycle. And it's going to have three components. So forward flow of time going one way, backward flow of time going the opposite direction that our senses do not pick up on, except for our psychic senses can, and where the two time flows come together in a unity point or a zero point. And so there was actually one Hopi thing, one where they actually talked about that somewhere, about at some point in time the backward flow of time would be discovered. So we'll go with the forward flow, the way we perceive time normally. And on yours, it's an eek glyph, a four eek. Blue Otter's birth sign is a nine eek. So you got an eek connection between you two. And the eek is a T-cross glyph, and it relates to spirit, prayer, you know, things, you know, of a spiritual nature, especially, you know, you probably tie it into like almost like in the chakras, like kind of the throat chakra, you know, with the wind, breathing. And there's a lot more importance to that than what people think and understand. And it has a partnering energy here of the dog thing again. So that dog thing is probably pretty prevalent with you. And a lot about, you know, things here are really about kind of service in a community and just service to people and helping out people and stuff and service to humanity and stuff. So, you know, it looks like you may have been doing this all along, more or less, maybe since you were born. Maybe you've been thinking about stuff like that for a long time in one way or another. Has a component here, connection to the sun, as well as being a component of that service and spirituality. So you probably do pretty good doing some sun gazing. On the other flow of time, the backward flow, the one we don't normally pick up on, coming from the next world cycle back into us, yours is relates to warrior and condor energy, like in the prophecy of the eagle and condor. So it's more in the southern hemisphere. And this one is also has an interesting relationship with the, particularly with two white buffaloes, the at Janesville, Wisconsin, the Miracle and Miracle Second Chance, those two. This particular thing is not a dead hit, but it's very close proximity to that. So there might be some things or connections with you and that whole white buffalo thing. And the things I'm going to talk about here are things that probably you may have noticed showing up a little bit more recently in your life. Usually we say 1997, 1998 time frame, a little bit before, a little bit after that, but somewhere around there. And it's, like I said, kind of a warrior energy, but it's not a warrior in terms of fighting, you know, combat stuff, but it's a warrior fighting for reason, justice, peace, looking into things. A certain partnering energy of here of you using things that are artistic and very creative things. So this is not necessarily directly you yourself, but something that can come in to partner with you and help you out. So that may have happened already, or maybe more of it going to happen. A lot of this is leading in a direction of change and change of things, transmutation of things. A death of something leading to a birth of something else. Maybe, you know, like the death of the current way that things are working in this world cycle and birthing a new world cycle. But what is working on giving birth to you, that warrior energy and all the stuff and reason Justin was talking about, is working in terms of building a cooperative, communal community, tribal-based community type of atmosphere or feeling about it is kind of a direction that you might be moving towards. Things like that are probably going to be pretty attractive. Where these two time flows come together, the forward and backward, This is kind of your bridge or doorway between world cycles, not only for you to go across the vision through the door, but also to take other people with you and help them. And this one, the key words on it are things like thought, synchronicity of things, just things just happening, just connecting. The movement of things, and that'll relate maybe towards the movement in your equations, the movement of how consciousness and energy move or relate to each other. And a big factor here that's driving it is essentially, in two words, never-ending love. That's a big factor. And it has a partnering energy of prophecy stuff, kind of bringing things alertness, waking things up, wakefulness, prophecy, heaven and earth type thing, especially when it has to do with balance and also truth. And this would relate to something that some of the Hopi elders wrote about in the newsletter, the Land and Life newsletter, traditional newsletter. They said, we cannot fight the problem here on Earth using the same strategy or techniques of forcing our will upon others like the other people are doing. We can't use that. We can't fight fire with the same fire. They said the only thing that we have to use is the power of the energy of truth itself. And this right here is showing up. That's showing up in your reading right here. So that will be truth and balance are very probably very driving things for it right now. Now the other one that I mentioned on the warrior energy and the white buffaloes, that also has a truth component linkage to it as well, but it's not with balance, it's with peace. So and the idea here is you can't really have peace without balance. If there's no balance, there ain't going to be any peace. So balance, peace, and truth are going to be probably things that are very prevalent in your life right now. I mean, very powerful things. And then the prophecy and artistic things are going to be side things that come in and support that for you. Okay? That makes sense?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Well, it's surprising, isn't it, just how spot on they can be. Well, just tell us how you got on this path and whatever you feel like. Posterity, for as long as the internet runs, what do you want them to hear?
Okay, well, I would like to start with, when I was a young man, I was, after I got my degree in chemistry, what happened was, in my senior year, I had, during my time as a chemistry student, I had gotten straight A's, and the first time at the school where anybody had gotten 100% on their exams, and I did that routinely. And then in my senior year, in the summer between my junior and senior year in 1966, a friend of my father's got me involved in the life insurance industry, selling insurance to college students, which gave me a training in how to be, other than a bookworm, how to come out and talk to people. And I still don't know if it was because I got interested in that, or what happened in my senior year for an elective. I took a class that everybody feared, the graduate level class called Advanced Physical Chemistry. And it was kind of like peeking behind the curtain. What do they teach you after you get your bachelor's degree? And that class changed really my perception of the nature of where science was at, because the teacher was the same teacher that I took my quantitative analysis course from And I got the first A that he ever gave in the history of the school, which wasn't that long at that time, but still, it wasn't the teacher problem that I had. So when he started that course, in the first lecture, he starts off like this. He says, "Everything we've told you and taught you up till now isn't true." And everybody went gasp. And then he says, what we've been teaching you, if you can think back, each year we're teaching you better and better models of what we think is true. And but because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, we don't believe that you can ever know anything with 100% certainty. We can only know something is true with a higher and higher probability that it's true. And so when he started off this course denying the very nature of the absolute nature of truth, it kind of blew my mind, to say the least. And then the whole rest of the course was complex mathematical distribution equations about probabilities of this and that and the other as applied to various physical chemistry principles. And boy, was that ever boring and hard to sit through. And I got, you know, I didn't get an A in that class. That was the only chemistry class I didn't get an A in. So after that, I decided, well, I can't go on with my goal of being a research chemist if everything they think is in denial of the basic fundamental principle of the absolute nature of truth. So I went ahead and made a career in sales and sales management, got married, had a baby, took my father's advice as a veteran in the Navy in World War II and stayed out of the military. And then by the time 1973 came around, my marriage was falling apart and I was going, you know, what's it all about? And I meditated and I had taken this course in 1972 called Mind Dynamics, which was they billed it as a scientific yoga class that you could learn how to control your brain rhythms and go down into deep meditative states after a 4-day intensive class that was equivalent to like 20 years of practicing yoga kind of thing. So I got a lot out of that. And in the course of that class, we all learned a little bit and experienced remote perception, things like Edgar Cayce was doing, diagnosing illnesses and getting visions about people, what was wrong with them and stuff like that. And so, you know, I had grown up in a family where my parents were both interested in the mind, and that's the kind of stuff I read all as a kid and a teenager, their books on the shelf about mysteries of the mind kind of thing. So then I went on a kind of got this, some, I thought, well, I better go in the mountains or in the desert like Jesus did and meditate for a sign from God kind of thing of what to do with the rest of my life. So June 23rd, 1973, I took off on this drive and left my family for a few weeks to be on my own and think about these things. And this is where I've never gotten an answer, but a very strange thing happened that changed the whole course of my life, where I was driving along and I was thinking, you know, I wonder if in the future humanity has actually solved the problems that the world faces, because otherwise, you know, the Vietnam War was going on and everything. Otherwise, it looked like we were on a path towards, you know, basically the total destruction of life on Earth. And so I thought, well, we've either fixed that in the future or there's no future and everything's dead, you know, somewhere in the future. So as I was meditating on this concept, and all of a sudden, this is about 9 o'clock in the morning, going up to Central Valley in California, a strange thing happened that I've never heard anybody have an experience like it, where it was as though something turned off a switch in my head. And normally when you're driving, you know, you can daydream and think about whatever you want while you're driving along. but my ability to think about anything else was gone. And for like a good 5 to 7 minutes, the only thing that was in my head was a sound that was so loud, so vivid, that I had to keep looking around, even though I was in the middle of the desert, to see if it was a speaker somewhere that was making a sound in my head. And there was the sound of toe rock. And it was over and over and over, you know, toe rock, like a voice, but not a voice, not a computerized voice, just like a human voice or just the sound. And then then at the end of that time, it was just exactly like a switch was turned off in my head, and I could think about anything I wanted. But of course, I pondered on this sound. What the heck was that? What does this mean? So my first inspiration was, well, is this a name that I'm supposed to take? You know, I know a lot of people, you know, take weird names instead of their regular names for some spiritual purpose or something, but I didn't feel like that. And I felt like what it was some kind of a guide beam signal coming from the future through time into the past that the people could tune into, and it was like a guide beam to help direct their decisions towards service to humanity and the solution to the problem of more or less fixing the situation and leading to this future of peace and harmony and more or less what I call paradise on earth. And so I that cut my trip short. I didn't have to do 40 days meditation. It just happened like naturally. And then a week or so later, I turned around, went back home. Meanwhile, that made my family life kind of fall apart. And then I was really keen and intent that I had to follow the direction of whatever this intuitive guidance was. And so I just abandoned all plans and took a year and thought about this. And I wrote up this copious plan about, you know, how to save the world kind of thing, all these different ideas and breakdowns and organizations and things like that, how to make it all happen in terms of a cybernetics program. That's what I felt that Torak was like a program to help guide, like cybernetically, the future to this promised future of peace and harmony. So that eventually, after 1973, by the next summer, I decided I needed to move up to Santa Barbara and apply for the PhD program in chemical physics there, because you didn't have to have a master's degree. You could just do it with a bachelor's degree. And I had good letters of recommendations from my teachers and everything. So I went up and did that. And during the process of, you know, writing up my application and meditating on what I wanted to do my thesis about, as I explained this completing Einstein's vision of this unified field theory concept, I sat down at the desk in my little apartment and got the inspiration to write out these equations, first three equations. And during that intense day when I was doing that, I had this eerie feeling, like almost as though there was up on the wall behind me, there was these not cameras, but some sort of physical, like I was on TV from somewhere in the future, and a bunch of entities were watching me and kind of guiding me or like that while I was doing this. And then the key thing of this theory of mine is, you know, in science, there's two basic principles: that reality exists independent of and identically observable by all observers. So what I came up with was, from my study of personality quantification using graphoanalysis class my mother took So I was familiar with it when I was a teenager. And then a study that I did intensely in 1972, where it's a scientific empirical study. You can go to IGAS.com and check it out, International Graphical Analysis Society. But they use this technique in all kinds of ways for marriage counseling, for business applications, to find out who's a truthful person, who's got fears that are inhibiting so much their development and all this kind of stuff. So I realized as a part of that study, people who have psychic abilities have certain characteristics in their handwriting that indicate that. You can tell a person with overt psychic abilities just by looking at their handwriting. And so by that time I had heard of Uri Geller and his mental ability to bend spoons with his mind, and I'd studied the crystallography micrograms and the explanations, that there wasn't any explanation for how it was done. It wasn't heat, it wasn't force, something unknown that did it. And I realized that this meant that the one of these two fundamental principles of science was incorrect, that reality is not identically observable by all observers, because the power of observation through the application of the human mind influences the reality that that person observes or produces, in the case like Uri Geller or Satya Sai Baba, whose handwriting also indicates the same psychic kind of traits with a really strange, unusual thing about his willpower being focused in the future. So anyway, I then went on to, after that, turned in my application, my $50, and I waited around, and then a month later they sent me a rejection letter, and then I wondered, well, now what am I going to do? So I was wandering around Isla Vista, and I saw a poster for a gathering in December of 1974. It was going to be in Ojai, and the poster was done by the person convening it, Jonathan Damien, who goes now by Jai Damien, and I looked at his handwriting, and it showed some of these same strong psychic traits, as well as, which involves also heavy reliance on intuition, which is indicated by the degree of breaks between the letters in each word, and just a very intelligent, amazing-looking guy from his handwriting. So I thought, I got to go to this gathering just to meet this guy. So I went there, and it was akin to a rainbow gathering where everybody was loving with everybody, and it was, but it was more focused into healing circles, and he would use his power, really, of mind to, in a circle of people, to focus the energy into creating healing events for people that would relieve them of various illnesses and conditions and mental instabilities or whatever. And so I was very impressed with that. And then I decided, well, I'm going to try to, after the gathering, I want to meet this guy more and talk to him. And I did. And then he said, well, I'm going to Mexico to a yoga retreat with Baba Haridas. And I convinced him, well, I want to go along with you. And so he took me with him. And then outside of Guadalajara, we got stopped at a federal police roadblock and arrested for a handful of pot that we had in the car. And then as a result, because I was the one who insisted we get it, even though he bought it, I took responsibility for it. And then he got out, and I spent 9.5 months in prison in Guadalajara in 1975, during which time I met my first Indians, so to speak, the Wichol people that were arrested during the same time I was, in a firefight where a bunch of people were killed, and they had long hair, and I just vibed into them as, wow, these are what Indians are, you know? And then I kind of developed a psychic connection with them in a certain way. And then during that time, I read for the first time this book called Warriors of the Rainbow, written in 1962 by Vincent Brown and William Loya, two Baha'i Faith members who were taken by the Hopi prophecy, especially because the prophesied one to come in the Hopi language called Bahana is very close in pronunciation to Baha'u'llah, the founder of their Baha'i faith. So they wrote this elaborate book, which was amazing to me because it was a comparison of various prophecies from around the world, of various different major religions, kind of minor religions, and a whole bunch of different indigenous traditions, cultures from around the world, what their prophecies were. And then it had a chart in the back, and it was showing how there was a common thread, and all these prophecies were actually coming true in our time. These different ones were saying more or less the same things. And this kind of blew my mind to think that there was a source of knowledge outside of reason, outside of what science thinks of a good mind as you build it up by knowledge that you learn, where all these knowledge that these people were getting that were talked about in these books were things they received psychically, like from dreams and visions, and apparently it was all coming from the same source. So these are some of the things that just kind of blew my mind about this whole concept of the Warriors of the Rainbow. And then when I got out and came back to Santa Barbara, Jonathan published an article in the December 74-75 All One Voice, it was called, the magazine he was publishing about my theory. So that was the first time that I had anything published, even though it was in a small, obscure, kind of hippie-style magazine type of thing. And then I decided to move back to Santa Barbara, and I did that in February of 1976. And then at the place where I lived, the guy called it, he let me live there in a tent because I didn't have any money, and he called it Dharma Home. And he was into the Tibetan Buddhism and all kinds of stuff and all the art that they had and things. And then he was doing videotape with a friend, and then he had videotaped Thomas Banyaka, the Hopi interpreter, speaking in Los Angeles the month before at the International Cooperation Council meeting. And I was completely blown away by this guy, Thomas Banyaka, because he talked for 45 minutes and in a low monotone kind of voice. You could see people nodding off all the time in the audience. He was like almost hypnotizing them with this message that he was delivering about the Hopi prophecy. And he never blinked once during 45 minutes. And now I know that he didn't, even though I blinked, you could think, well, maybe he blinked when I blinked, but he couldn't have, because during that whole time, you could see from the close-up and the reflection of the light, his eyes were filled with tears to the point where if he blinked, it would drop a tear down his face, but he never blinked. So the fluid was just coming out and going back in and maintaining this reservoir of liquid to where he didn't have to blink. So he was just channeling like I've never heard or seen of anything. And I was totally blown away by that in February of 76. And during that time, I partnered up. I met a wonderful woman that became my wife, and I'm still in love with and in contact with. And she's afraid to be supportive of my radical work anymore, but she was very close with me and witnessed a lot of things that happened the next first few years. In May 28, 1976, Thomas came to Santa Barbara, and a smaller gathering, maybe a couple of dozen or so people in a house there in Santa Barbara. And he gave essentially the same talk, but it was a little bit less hypnotic, so to speak, more personable because there was fewer people, and he wasn't just looking out into a dark audience from a lit stage. And so, you know, how speakers do, they look around the room from time to time to each person as they're speaking, and he gave the same talk, but this time, when he got to the point where he says, "And the true white brother is coming to the Hopi land very soon, wearing red and bringing many new inventions," that was the only time during his talk where he looked directly into my eyes, fixed into my gaze during that whole phrase, and then looked away afterwards and never looked at me again. And I just got chills up and down my spine. And I could hardly believe the effect that it had on me, because I knew that this still incomplete theory of mine was going to result in many kinds of new inventions that would help, you know, bring about this change in the course of history. And that's what I found out that the Hopi prophecy was about, too, that some event will occur in the future that will change the course of history off of the path towards total destruction and onto the path towards peace and harmony and abundance and no money and more or less paradise on earth. And so I decided, as a result of that, and Carolyn was with me at the time during that whole talk by Thomas. So I told her afterwards, wow, you know, what I had felt. And just at the end of, after his talk, he gave out copies of his document called the Hopi Declaration of Peace. Well, we went up to the mountains to a campground and spent a day, and I swear that I read that thing over meditatively at least 100 times, and it just blew my mind that what it contained in terms of a message. And so I decided, well, you know, I feel like I should, or we, representing the men and women, one man, one woman, because the true white brother whose skin may or may not be white, maybe many in population, that we should go and get two. I didn't know where I should wear something red and go to the Hopi land and explore this and see what happens. So I thought, well, I'm a chemist. The only thing I don't have, like, I'm not a monk with the robes or anything. What only thing I have that symbolic of my faith in science is my lab coat. So I'd say, well, we should go get two lab coats and dye them red and go to the Hopi land and see what happens. And she believed in me so much, she just accepted it and had faith. And then, so we went to my alma mater down from Santa Barbara. We drove down to Cal State Northridge and went to the bookstore. And there was only two white cotton lab coats left, so we bought them. And then within a week or so, I lost my nerve. I figured, this is silly. You know, I'll be embarrassed. Who will people think I am? You know, this is kind of like way over the top thing to think of doing. So the only way I can go through with it is if I get a sign from God, like, you know, Moses got the burning bush. So if I get some kind of strong sign like that, then I'll know I'm supposed to do this. And if I don't, then I don't have to. But I couldn't just tell her I changed my mind, because she had such strong faith in me. So she had some friends with the Boy Scout camp that they maintained up in the Bay Area. So we went up there and camped out. And then on June 14th, 1976, I left her to meditate on my mission at the campground down below. Then I walked up to the top of this mountain overlooking the San Francisco Bay from Fairfax, California. And it was just only a couple of years since I'd taken this mind dynamics class. So I, you know, took off. It was a warm day. I took off all my clothes, sat down cross-legged in the grass and facing the San Francisco Bay. And, you know, I saw like a dozen hawks circling on the way up, but that wasn't strong enough. And so I closed my eyes to get into a meditation on this, whether I should do this thing or not. And I meditated on that Hopi symbol, the circle, quadrisected circle with the circle in each quadrant. I was meditating as though that was on the ground in front of me. And I was in the Hopi land, and that was the spot that they recognized as the center of the universe for peace. I didn't realize at the time that there wasn't any one spot like that, but I imagined that it was the Four Corners Monument or something like that. But anyway, I quickly was able to go to my levels, as we call it, get down into the low brain rhythms. And then when I, so, you know, it was at the most 10 minutes or so that I was in this meditation, because I was convinced that I wasn't going to get any kind of strong enough sign. But I could then just go down the mountain and tell her, oh, I didn't get a sign, therefore we don't have to go do this embarrassing thing. But what happened was, when I opened my eyes, my gaze was, where my gaze first was affixed, was at the edge of the San Francisco Bay. And during the time that my eyes had been closed, there was a thin column of dense white smoke that had formed at the edge of the San Francisco Bay, and then almost like an exclamation mark without the dot at the bottom. And then within a few minutes, I could see the flames at the bottom, like the dot under the exclamation point, and a kind of a brush fire had started while my eyes were closed. And then it proceeded to come up the canyon right towards me. And then after 20 minutes, it was getting all smoky everywhere, and fire was everywhere coming at me. And then I kind of had one foot pointed toward the bay and one foot toward the other side of the mountain, ready to run down the hill and say, let's get the hell out of here. And then all of a sudden the wind changed and made it veer off to the left. And then in another 5 or 10 minutes, these borate bombers came over and spread red borate solution all over those fires. So I go, I still get chills talking about it, but so I go, oh my God, I can't deny this is a sign. This means I have to go through this embarrassing thing. So I went down the mountain, explained the vision to Carolyn, and then we decided to go up to the summer solstice gathering in Harbin Springs. It was going to be a week later. Oh, and by the way, I only found out later that June 14th is Flag Day. So that's the United States Bicentennial Flag Day that event happened. You were talking about synchronicities earlier. Well, this is just the start of so many.
Wow.
That I could say. But so we decided to go to this gathering and dye the lab coats there. Jai Damian was hosting it, and it would be the same kind of spiritual vibe that started me on this path kind of thing. So, but we figured we're not prepared. We should go back to Santa Barbara first, get some things in order, because if we're going to go all the way to the Hopi Land, we're going to need some more stuff. So we got in her little car, and she was in the process of divorce from her then husband. And so we just drove south, and we headed to Santa Cruz on the way. And if you've ever been on that road going into Santa Cruz from the north, you know that it's kind of scary because you're at the edge of a cliff so many times as you go around the right side there on that road. And then we pulled off the off-ramp into Santa Cruz, and then halfway down the off-ramp, the transmission on the car locks up, and the car skids to a halt on the right side of the off-ramp. And if it had happened, 20 minutes earlier, we'd have probably been going over the cliff. But this time I'm feeling like I don't have to even think of what to do. My whole course is guided. It's predetermined. I can just relax and follow the flow kind of thing. So we grab the few things that we had in a backpack and the last few dollars that we had the time to get back for gas money, and we go walking into Santa Cruz, and then we go by this bookstore, and I get in there and I find the Warriors of the Rainbow book, which I hadn't seen since the previous year, and I get that and study it some more. Then we go to this place called the Catalyst. It's like a bar, a restaurant where you can get beer and that. So we use our last money to buy a pitcher of beer and sit down at this table and go, okay, well, God, what's going to happen next? And then I spread out all these papers on the table about the All One Family Union gathering coming up and the Where's the Rainbow book and all these different things. And then this young man comes over and says, well, what's this all about? What's up? And we tell him, you know, basically a short version of the last part of what I told you, and that we're going to this gathering, and we don't have a way now. And he says, well, I'm a religious studies major here at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm graduating, and I don't know what to do for the summer. I'll give you a ride. So we wait around, you know, a couple of days for him to finish his, get ready and finish his last graduation stuff. And then he takes us up to this gathering, and then we buy dye and all that, a bucket and so forth, and bring it with us. And then as soon as we dye the lab coats and hang them out to dry, the fire breaks out up at that gathering. And people are all scrambling around, and then they put it
wow.
out. And then he picks up a girlfriend, and then four of us head to the Hopi land, you know. And the timing was that on June 24th, 1976, Barbara Marks Hubbard was hosting a gathering at Cape Canaveral in Florida called the Horizons Day, Visions for the Next 200 Years of the United States kind of thing, and inviting people from wherever they were to have meetings locally and come up with a statement about that, and then send it in, call it in on the telephone and dictate it. And then they would compile all these statements into a document and give it to the president and a copy to all the Congress people and all that. But that was our goal, to go to the Hopi land. The four of us have this kind of put our heads together and channel this kind of a document to give to the Horizons Day Council. So as we go to the Hopi land, every, like, at least I'd say four times, maybe five times, we would pull off the road for a break, you know, have a picnic or like that kind of thing. We'd go around a corner and there would be a field on fire, just mysteriously, just fire, you know, burning and nobody there. And then this happened like three or four times, maybe five times on our trip. And then when we get there, we do this Horizons Day thing. Our council, I had brought along my mom's manual typewriter from way back when and typed it up and then read it on the phone from the trading post there, the store in Kikotsumovi, New Araibi, read it into the record, and they sent me a copy later with our little contribution in there. And then those two people left to go to the Rainbow Gathering in Montana that year, which I probably would have gone to except for this thing that happened. And so then I decided that I should write up a report to the Hopi and go to Thomas Bunyaka's house and deliver it on the 4th of July, the bicentennial 4th of July. So by this time, we were camped at the, Carolyn and I had camped at the Araibi Wash picnic area. And then it was minimal stuff, you know, a little frying pan, sleeping bag, and slept on the ground and this kind of thing. And then every day I would walk into the town and just sit there on the bench outside the store with my red lab coat on, you know, just waiting to see what would happen. And then on the 4th of July, turned out to be a Sunday, so I went to Thomas's house. We both went there wearing our red lab coats, and then I delivered a bunch of documents to him, including the Horizons Day thing and an explanation of this and that and the other, the message I felt to deliver, along with a palm-size kind of a rock that I found. They have in that area kind of like, looks like a little tablet that I inscribed on it the first three of these equations of the tetron theory on it, because I knew it had something to do about tablets. And so then he just greeted us and said hello and gave us a little quick impromptu message. But, you know, we didn't go in or anything. I was kind of too embarrassed to, and I knew Carolyn was. So we left that. And then we decided to go to the Mennonite church because they had a Hopi Mennonite church there. So we go to the church service. She takes off her red lab coat, and that's, I think, the last time she ever wore it. Just she didn't see the fire sign that I did, so she didn't have this kind of abiding depth of faith that I did. And so we go into the church and sit in the back. I'm sitting there with my red lab coat on. Different preachers give their lecture or testimony or whatever in English, but all the songs are sung in Hopi. They're familiar songs I'd known from churches I'd been to in the past, Presbyterian, Christian Science, Unity, and Unitarian, and so forth. So it's kind of interesting. And then the pastor invites us to lunch at his house afterwards. So, okay, so we go there. And then he also has this elder from Oribe who used to be a book written about him called Sun Chief. He was the leader of the Sun Clan in Oribe until he became a Christian. And then they wouldn't let him be that anymore in their tradition. And so they explained to us why they became Christians with the background of their Hopi faith. And it was because they saw a parallel between the prophecies in the Bible about the return of Jesus Christ and the return of this Hopi person called the Bahana. And so I was, impressed with that. I, of course, had my own beliefs at the time about Jesus, but I didn't really consider myself a devout Christian or anything, certainly not like they were, and I'd never really studied the Bible. So thank you very much. And then we went back to camp, and then she got lonely for her children, and it was a little bit too hard to be out there like we were, so she took a bus back to Santa Barbara. Then came back a few weeks later, and meanwhile I kept pursuing this there myself and going every day to the walking the mile into the town and sitting around with my red lab coat. And one of the times Grandfather David Menunge was brought there with a fellow that was going to make a phone call at the payphone there, and I could see him elbowing the guy in the truck before they got out and pointing at me, obviously, because I'm there with red on. And so when the guy comes in to make the phone call, Grandfather David walks over to me, and I stand up to greet him, and he just walks up to me very silently, and I have my hands kind of clasped together in front of me as he did. And then he came up to me so close, just quietly, to where the long hairs on the back of his hand were rubbing on mine. And then he looks at me in the eye and he says, "I am your brother." And that's all he said. And then pretty soon the church bells rang. That was another Sunday behind him. And he goes, "Oh, church bells." And then the guy finished the phone call, and then they walk away. But he must have stood there like that, just in silence for like 5 to 7 minutes or so. And then they get in the truck and drive away. So that was kind of interesting. And then what happened next, it was noteworthy, was on the 17th of July, 1976, and the 18th, they had 2-day Kachina dances in that new Oribe village, Kikotsumavi. And so I went there, and the first day and just sat there all day and watched the Kachina dances, and found out that was called the Comanche dance. The Hopi traditionally adopt prayers of different tribes nearby as a way of making peace and good relations with them. And I saw Thomas Banyaka there for a while that day watching the dance too in the village where he lived, and then went back to camp. And then when I got back to camp, there was this dude there named James who had hitchhiked down with basically nothing. I don't even think he had a blanket. Maybe he had a blanket. He'd hitchhiked down from the Rainbow Gathering in Montana, and he felt he had this mission to come to the Hopi land. And he was one of these guys who was way out there into the revelations and biblical prophecies, and he knew the Bible back and forth, everything like that. And he said he had met David Manunge that day. He just sort of was at the picnic table where I was camping, just sitting on it, talking to this last Hopi guy, giving him a ride. And then I go, oh, well, I don't know what's going on. And then when I show up, the Hopi guy leaves. Here's this guy sitting at my table going, I'm on a mission from God kind of thing. So I go, well, he says, I want to meet Thomas Banyaka. So I said, well, I just saw him today at the Kachina dance. It's going to happen again tomorrow. I'll go with you. I'll take you with me, and we'll go meet him. I'll introduce you to him. We'll go to his house. And so we do that. But the next morning of the 18th, as we're, you know, I fix a little breakfast, and then we decide, okay, then we're getting ready to go in to walk to town. And I look up in the sky. We look up in the sky, and there's this double rainbow formed. Deep colors. It was the first double rainbow I'd ever seen in my life. It lasted like 20 minutes. And then as it's still going on, we walk into town to the first at Thomas's house, knock on the door. His wife tells us he's out of town. He's gone somewhere on a speaking engagement kind of thing. So I say to James, let's go over to the Kachina dances. And it's a Sunday, so I'll take you to the church, you know, Mennonite church, after we watch the Kachina dances for a while. So we go to watch the Kachina dances. And unlike the other villages that I'd been to see their dances, I don't remember how I got to them because I was on foot, but somehow during those weeks, in this particular dance area, they had two poles, like 10-foot or 12-foot poles, like almost like small telephone poles that were about, you know, 10 feet apart. That was the entryway where the Kachina dancers came in and out as to go into the dance arena. And then, so just sort of automatically, without any thought, James and I took up a position to watch the dances, one on each outer edge of these two poles. And we stand there and we're listening to this sort of hypnotic songs that are magnified by their reverberations and the masks and everything, and tripping out on all what's going on. And then we talked about it afterwards. We both got this eerie feeling at the same moment, and we turned our heads and looked at one another, and then we looked back away from the other direction from the dance, and here come these other two Kachinas walking towards us, towards the entryway, and they're dressed differently. They're not the same kind of Kachinas as the ones in the dance. These guys are holding like little Christmas trees kind of thing, and they walk in to the dance arena, and then between the two posts where we are. And when we talked about it later, we felt like somehow psychically, whatever they represented, and we didn't know what it was at the time, was somehow connected to our being there and our individual and joint mission, spiritual mission. So these two Kachinas go in, and they go, they start their song. First we see them, we don't hear them. And then as they approach, we start hearing their song. And then they go by, and then they're going to the dance arena, and they go one by one to the four directions, facing the dancers in the middle, and singing this song. their song, their prayer song, and then you could tell that there was something special about these two guys, because these two spirits represented by the dancers, because the clowns in the Hopi Kachina dance, they're the most experienced dancers, and they're dressed up as clowns to kind of monitor the energy of the whole thing. So they, you know, if somebody's foxtail comes loose on the dancers, they go up and tuck it in. If the they go do strange, weird things around to the public to diffuse energy, to keep the prayer on track and this kind of thing. But these, the
David,
clowns...
David.
Yes.
Did one of these Kachinas have kind of a, almost like a conical head?
No, and I'll tell you in a minute what I discovered about them afterwards.
Okay.
But what happened was that the clowns treated these two Kachinas with such deference, they wouldn't even look at them. They wouldn't even face them. They intentionally kept their bodies in a position where they were, at all times, they had their backs to these two Kachinas that came in. So we stood there a little while and watched this after they went to the third position of the four directions, and then the church bells rang. So I looked at James and motioned to him, and then we left, and we walked over to the church. As we got to the church, it burst out raining the last, 20 feet as we walked up to the door. As I touched the door to open the door to the church, there was instantaneous lightning and thunder. Then we opened the door. I go in with James. We sit in the back. I'm wearing my red lab coat like always. And then we listen to the thing. And then the pastor invites us to lunch again. And I go, I'm looking forward to this because I want to see if there's any two people on earth that agree about the interpretation of the Bible. And both James and the Mennonite preacher know the Bible backwards and forwards. So I'm going to be very interested in what they talk about over lunch. So sure enough, they're getting into the Bible prophecies about the return of Jesus Christ. And they go through the chronology. This is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and then this, and then eventually this physical and bodily return will happen. And I'm astonished that they actually agree point by point on all these things. So then we finish lunch, and then we go back, and we watch the Kachina dances a little more, and then we turn around, time to go back to camp, we turn around, there's another huge double rainbow in the sky, like deep colors, last 20 minutes kind of thing, as we're walking back to the camp. So that kind of blew my mind, to say the least. And then as James left the next day, his mission was done. And so one by one, young Hopi people would come by and talk to me at the camp. And of course, you never know. It's anonymous who's a Kachina dancer that you're not supposed to say or tell or anything. But obviously some of the ones that came by were Kachina dancers, and they recognized me from being there and that I had this red lab coat on and everything. So it was explained to me that these two Kachinas were called the last hope prayer of the Hopi people. They're called the morning Kachinas. And they represent the last hope prayer of the Hopi people. And they'd never been seen. They never appeared in a lifetime of elders living now even over 100 years old. That was the first time they'd ever seen them come out. And that the two men who portrayed those Kachinas in the dance had fasted without sleep, without food, without water, singing that song for 4 days before they appeared at that time. So, again, these kind of things, I get chills just talking about them, and I never get a chance to talk to people about this. But this was, I'd say, the big highlight of that day of my trip there. And then Carolyn came back. I stayed around. We stayed around together a few more weeks into August. And then I decided, you know what, the Hopi people are just as messed up and disunited between the tribal council and all this.
As
everywhere in the world. You know, and part of the reason I thought was there is no place, there is no one spot that they recognize as the center of the universe for peace. It's just the general area. So I thought, well, you know, the solution might be to create some sort of a peace center, an actual spot where you build some, you know, pile of rocks even that you recognize as the spiritual center. So when Carolyn came back, she got a ride with this guy who with him had brought these things called light sticks, the chemical lights that are real popular now, but that was, they were brand new then. And they had just been used to close the prayer of the Olympics that year in 1976 as a closing event to the Olympics. At night, everybody held up one of these light sticks and broke them, you know, cracked the thing inside and shook them, and they all lit up. So it was like a prayer for peace kind of thing. And he brought some of these light sticks. Well, in the Warriors of the Rainbow book, the part about the Hopi prophecy, it says the true white brother will be bringing a new light from the east. Well, the Olympics were in the east, and this is a new kind of light. So I got a bunch of these things and then started doing a little prayer with various people I met. We would just, I would say Torah and then break it, and then we would just have a meditation. And then so at the end of our journey to the Hopi land, there's a Catholic church out on the very edge, far end of Araibi Mesa, that had been struck by lightning and destroyed, you know, some 100 years or something back, but the ruins were still there. So I decided, well, that's a sign from God. We should go there and take some rocks, because it was built of stone. We should take four of those rocks, and by this time, the two other helpers had shown up. They were like mine. So in the night, on the new moon in August, we walked up the trail secretly to Araibi Wash and up to Araibi Mesa, and went into these ruins and took four of these rocks, paid a little ceremony, and broke one of the light sticks open and lit it up and cut it open and poured the oil from it on these four rocks. And then we just left them there as a prayer for, let's maybe someday use these rocks and rebuild what was this Catholic church into a Hopi Peace Center kind of thing. So then we left and then came back to Santa Barbara. And then in December of that year, you know, some of the Hopi prophecy stuff that I was studying was still a mystery to me. The true white brother is supposed to have, again, whose skin may or may not be white and who may be many in population. He's supposed to have the help of two helpers. And while I was there, I got the four-page letter that Thomas Banyaka had written in December or January of 1961, after the second historic meeting of all the elders from all the villages in December 1960, this is the first time he rendered their comparative prophecy teachings into writing. He had rendered it orally and delivered it faithfully since 1948, the first of those meetings, and the second and last of those meetings in December 60, he wrote this four-page letter, and he sent it to somebody in Germany and some copy to somebody in Japan, because Germany and Japan had used these symbols of the two helpers. One, and it was very cryptically worded, this four-page letter, which was the letter that the chapter in the Warriors of the Rainbow book was written and abstracted from, shortened. And in the detailed letter, it said that the first helper would have two signs. One is the swastika, and one was something that looked like a four-leaf clover, or almost like the Maltese cross that the Germans used, you know. And then the other helper would have the sign of the sun, the second helper. And then it said in there that this major event that would happen to bring about the change in the course of history would involve the true one, the Pahana, and the second one, the first helper with the sign of the swastika and the kind of four-leaf clover shape, would join together with the third one, the second helper with the sign of the sun, and come as one to bring purification. So when we got back, I still didn't understand what the heck that was. So when we got back to Santa Barbara...
Hey, David.
Yeah.
I think one was supposed to be male and one the other female, as I recall.
That's
just something I've heard.
The red one in the arms of the cross or swastika was the female energy. And the other one, this will relate to David's work on energy because it relates to what the Lakota called skonskon. And you'll have two of them, and they'll be counter-rotational. So one will go clockwise, one counterclockwise. And the female, I can't remember now. I'm thinking it's counterclockwise, but I'm not sure.
Right.
But when you put them together, when the four flower, the four clover, four petal thing you're talking about, that particular symbol is going to connect to the sun. It will also connect back to Spider Woman.
I was
right.
kind of wondering
many,
whether
many.
And the two twins. The two twins.
I was
kind of
wondering maybe she was like, you know, just a shot in the dark. Maybe she was a German and Irish ancestry. And did James have any Asian ancestry?
No, and there's many interpretations of this, but I'd like to continue because I can explain what happened to me that answered
right,
those questions in my mind. What happened was we got back to Santa Barbara, and then in November, the Japanese Buddhist monks of the Nipponzan Myohoji order showed up at the place where we were staying at Dharma Home, and they were brought there by a I Ching teacher that had gone with them on the continental walk across country during that year, and they were beating these drums, these hand drums, and chanting this mantra, the Namu Myoho Renge Kyo mantra, and they were going to do fasting as they did everywhere, every year, all around the world, no food or water for 7 days the first week of December, leading up to December 8th, the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, where they have a big feast and a ceremony every year. So they came and they were, you know, beating these drums and they were looking like monks and all this shaved heads and all kinds of new things to me. And when we asked them, why do you do this? What's the purpose, the principle behind the chanting and the drumming and all this? And of course, they represent the sign of the sun, Nihon, meaning their Japan is in their language is Nihon, which is the origin of the sun. So they explained to us, oh, the reason we beat the drum in chanting is it's a process of self purification to bring about pure land, like paradise on earth. So I go, my mind goes bingo. There's the helper. So this monk named Nipashi, whose name means sun bridge or rainbow, Nipashi, and his first name is Masao, which is in Japanese means political man, but it's the same sound as the Hopi word for the great spirit that wanders the earth at night as a flame. And so this monk decides he's going to do the fasting and the chanting for the week in a teepee that's like 50 feet from the tent that I'm living in and hers next to me. And so I'm listening, and all day beating this drum, and he's chanting, and I'm going, what in the world? What is going on here? And he invites us to come and sit with him and chant and fast if we want. So after two or three days of just listening all day, I get the notion, well, I'm going to go and sit with him and get the vibe. And so I go and do that one day, all day. And then the next day, I decide, well, I'm going to chant with him a little bit. And so I pick up the drum and I chant a couple hours with him. And then he says, well, you know, you should fast with me one day. And I'm going, well, you know, I've never fasted before. But hell, if he can do it for 7 days, I can certainly do it for one day. So the last day, I sat with him all day and beat the drum and chanted and fasted. And that was a completely mind-blowing experience. I got insights that you just can't get from explanation. There's no way still that I can explain what happened to him. But as a result, I took up the drum and the chanting. I was basically the first Anglo-American to do so. This is the same from the same teacher that Mahatma Gandhi took up the same drum and the mantra every day during and after the success of the spiritual revolution in India, which Guruji went to support there, following Gandhi around, chanting and drumming and this kind of thing. And so I would follow this monk around town, beating the drum and chanting, and, you know, getting the experience behind it, what it meant. It was from him I learned how to dumpster dive, because they didn't buy things. They, you know, either people gave them things or they scrounged scraps to eat. And they never asked for money. This order, they never asked for donations or anything, which also impressed me, because that was the same kind of vibe that Satya Sai Baba had, which my parents introduced me to in the late 60s. He never asked for money. And that was an important part to me of what's really spiritual, is you don't deal with money in the way, you know, normal way, selling ceremonies and stuff like that. So then after a while, they opened a temple in Santa Barbara in the living room of this house, and the three of the monks, Napashi and two of the others, I chanted and fasted 3 days with them, and I think it was in January or February of 77. And then one of them wanted me to take him to the Hopi land, but because the teacher, Guruji, had found out that the American Indians still survived. In Japan, they thought they had all died. So he sent one of these monks to investigate and report back to him. So he wanted to go to the Hopi land, but he was such an odd guy that I felt reluctant to take him there. So instead he went and met Dennis Banks and developed a lifelong connection between them, the monks, and Dennis Banks. But in the process, I started realizing that this mantra that they use, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, has an uncanny similarity to the fundamental Islamic prayer, because I embraced Islam at the Los Angeles mosque meetings when I was 18 years old, under the tutelage of a friend of mine, a year older, who was a brilliant guy who had learned the Quran back and forth and learned Arabic and all the dances and the music and played the instruments, and he learned Russian and German and all these things. Just an amazing kind of guy. And so under his tutelage, I understood the fundamentals of the faith of Islam and embraced them at my age of 18. I never practiced in the prayer and all that, but I understood it and felt a real strong affinity for the belief in God as nothing happens in the world except that it happens in accord with the will of God, which is a different conception of God than Christianity or Judaism and so forth. So anyway, I started thinking about, it's really weird, La ilaha illallah is the same, seven syllables. The second syllable is a half beat. The same as Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. The second syllable is a half beat. Different languages, different cultures, but weird that they are like that, I thought. So one day, I started practicing. Nakashi went back to Japan to prepare for the Tokyo to Hiroshima Peace Walk that summer. And so I was alone. I was walking the streets of Santa Barbara, beating the drum and chanting by myself, but not very much, not very far. So one day I decided, okay, it's kind of like learning how to walk and chew gum at the same time, you know, beating the drum and chanting and keeping your breath and all this. And so I decided I'm going to walk 12 miles from where we were in the one end of Santa Barbara out to the university and chanting all day just for practice, you know. And so it was April 28th, 1977, and I walked, and then I was just tripping on this idea that La ilaha illallah, namu myoho renge kyo, what's the commonality? There must be something, some oneness behind them, even though they're from different languages and cultures. So as I was walking along, I thought to myself, okay, when I get to that red light up there, San Marcos Pass Road, I'm walking on the side. When I get to that light, I'm going to try one time, and I'm going to chant La ilaha illallah instead of Namu Myoho Renge Kyo while I'm walking along. So when I did that, I got this extreme vision, and it had to do with, at the time I was trying to learn how to write the calligraphy of the Namu Myoho Renge Kyo in the ancient Chinese language that they use. And one of the characters has these several lines going, horizontal lines going across. And I got this inspiration about the absolute identity of everything. And this was the insight that enabled me to complete the fourth equation of my tetron theory, which is the absolute identity function. That beyond the definitional character of the human mind, everything is one. All is one. The oneness principle kind of thing. So that kind of blew my mind. Then I finished that day. Then I found out later that April 28th was the anniversary of 700 some years ago where St. Nichiren first put the voice, the Namu Myoho Renge Kyo mantra from Mount Minobu in Japan. Another coincidence or synchronicity kind of thing. So that's how I came to conclude these equations and this insight. And then in the before that, it happened in March, around March, I forget, 4th or something, so a month or so earlier, the Holiness Karmapa came to Santa Barbara to do his black hat ceremony. And because the household where I was all into Tibetan Buddhism and so forth, I decided to go to it, and also I brought the one of the Buddhist monks, the one that made the connection with Dennis Banks later, to the ceremony, and we walked there chanting and beating the drum, and the Tibetan monks kind of took him aside and kind of sequestered him with some monks outside the ceremony because, you know, he was of a different order, I guess was the reason or whatever, and so Carolyn and I were there and took in this called refuge ceremony. And as a part of it, at the end, you walk up to the stage and he gives you this empowerment cord. The first thing that was astonished me when we sat down was under the podium where he was sitting to give his talk and put this meditative black crown on and just stare at us for a while and chant silently his mantra for 108 times and give us all whatever benefit that was to be. There was the tanka, the tapestry hanging below him, had the four swastikas in each corner, one in each corner, and it had the double gorge symbol in the middle, exactly the symbols of the second helper, the sign of the swastika and this four-leaf clover shape. And so I was, bingo, for me, there's the second helper, the Tibetans and the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. And then after that ceremony, they had the refuge ceremony where you could formally embrace Buddhism and get a Tibetan name and all this kind of thing, which you took part in. as a part of that, they took, they went around and they took, we were at the
David,
back of the room. So
I hate to, I hate to interrupt. We're going to be out of stream in 10 seconds. Let's continue this at a future time. And I wish we could go longer, but we just can't. We're going to leave everybody now. Good night, everybody.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Join us to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho. Hi friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklahoma Native American Church, or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us. And you'll receive this gift reading.